This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio. The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. An Israeli-owned ship was attacked off of Oman. Sources close to the resistance say that the attack was in response to Israeli attacks in Syria, especially the one on an airport in Syria's western Qusair region, where two resistance fighters were killed. Now, Tel Aviv is pointing the finger at Iran for the raid, where two crew members were killed. So far, Tehran has not commented on the attack. Stay with us as we take a look at the story on the Spotlight. I'd like to start it all off crossing over to Damascus and talking to Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali, thanks so much for being with us. Well, fill us in on what you know about this situation.
Yes, what we know is that there was an Israeli-owned ship attacked about 280 kilometers northeast of the coast of Oman. Of course, we have a resistance source that told the media that the attack was in response to the Israeli attack that happened about 10 days ago on Al-Qusair area, which is an area on the borderline between Syria and Lebanon, of course, on the Syrian side. Of course, Syria did not comment on the issue. However, Syria sent tens of letters to the United Nations Security Council calling on the international body on every, of course, Israeli attack to shoulder its responsibility in preserving international peace and security and taking measures against Israel in order to stop it from carrying out such attacks. Now, it really seems that the resistance source, giving such information, is saying that resistance forces in this region will not allow Israel anymore to attack resistance forces, to attack sovereign countries, and there will be a price for every attack. This is the first message that the resistance in the region wants to send to Israel. The second is a message to the international community. Of course, as I told you, Syria sent letters to the United Nations, called on the international community to do something. Nothing was done in the past 10 years. Israel continues to occupy Syria and attack it. And this is the second message, that if the international community is not going to do anything about such illegal attacks, the resistance will do.
All right, thanks so much for that update out of Damascus. That's Muhammad Ali. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program, political commentator Mohammed Obaid out of Beirut, and journalist and political commentator Sayed Mohsen Abbas out of London. Thank you both for being with us. So let's start this off in Beirut. And Mohammed, well, a source close to the resistance says this attack was a retaliation for Israeli aggression in Syria. Your take on the possibility of that and the importance of it, if it's true?
Well, first of all, you have to take into account that this method is being used in correspondence with what the Israelis have been doing. They have always been launching aggressions against Syria, against other areas, and letting the Arab press media report that it was Israel without the Israelis adopting this. But sometimes the Israeli officials could not take it anymore, and they used to brag about these aggressions and say that it was up to them to prevent what they call the axis of evil, which we call the axis of resistance, in order to claim a responsibility for these attacks. So what the resistance source has really done recently is that they have adopted the policy of this ambiguity, sort of, because you don't have an official claiming of responsibility by the Islamic Republic or by any resistance group, but it is understood that this is coming as part of or as a retaliation to the Israeli aggression against the Qusair area in Syria. So the Israelis are not really used to this, because throughout their history they have been acting with this thuggish way of behaving against other countries, against sovereign countries, and the world has always been turning a blind eye to these aggressions. So it is up to you then to defend yourself in order to sort of tit for tat. I mean, you have to make the aggressor pay a price for the aggressions that they are carrying out.
Said Moshe, your perspective, the significance of this Israeli ship being hit?
Well, the significance is that we no longer have a one-way traffic in terms of the Israelis routinely trying to roll out their Yinon plan by attacking their neighbors. We no longer have a free run for the Israelis to balkanize the Middle East. They no longer have the fear factor which they cultivated over many decades to cow all opposition into submission. Of course, with some backup, it was the American military backup which previously kept them floating. They actually are capable of making their own arms and are increasingly self-sufficient in that respect, but they still get over $3.8 billion worth of aid on paper. It's probably a lot more privately through all the American Zionist donors. So we know that Israel has used this kind of backup of American imperialism to create chaos and to create, terror in that region. Syria has been, of course, it's one of its major targets from a very long time. Basically, Syria did back the Palestinian movement in the region. They did back the Lebanese resistance. They were always, even under Hafez al-Assad, stoically opposed to Israeli imperialism and its the practices that they were carrying out in the region. And of course, as time's not gone on, what we've seen is the Israelis have been part and parcel of the creation of the civil war in Syria, first of all, then the launch of ISIS in Syria and Iraq and beyond. Israel is very much behind that. They not only are behind it, but they've also been servicing, training, and medically supporting the ISIS proxy forces in that region. So you can see there are multiple layers of Israeli provocation and, aggression against certainly Syria, certainly against Lebanon, certainly against all nations that want sovereignty and independence intact. In response, what we've seen is the confidence of the resistance growing. It started with Hezbollah managing to defeat, essentially, Israel's invasion of Lebanon, not once, but twice. And since then, it's the resistance that has been arguably on the front foot. Israel now relies on aerial power, terror from the air. But even that is becoming even more suspect, because we've seen Israeli missiles being intercepted, destroyed by Syrian air defense. Some argue it's the Russians who are doing that. Either way, it is Syria on paper which is rebutting Israel's attack. So it's actually reducing Israel's credibility as an undisputed power in that region.
Well, Mohammed, what about that? I mean, we've been seeing Israel illegally bombing Syria for years now. And now with the situation, with the bombing of this Israeli ship, we're seeing outrage being expressed by these Western countries. And mum is the word, more or less, when Israel continues to violate Syrian territory. Do you think this hypocrisy by these Western countries have revealed themselves more and more as far as their real intentions in dealing with this region, especially when it comes to Israel?
Well, we have to keep into account, we have to keep in our minds that if it weren't for the political and military and the financial aid provided by the Western countries, Israel would not even survive for one day in the region within this hostile atmosphere and environment that is everybody in the region regards Israel as an illegitimate entity that was based and erected on the usurpation of the land by of the Palestinians. So if it weren't for this political support of this turning the blind eye by the West to the Israeli aggressions and all the massacres that have been going on throughout our region for over 70 years now, Israel would not have been able to keep going with that. But this turns the other side, the side that is taking the blows, I mean, the other countries, the countries that have been receiving the aggressions of the Israeli entity, turn more bold because you cannot remain on the side of the being killed while remaining silent. So you have to manage, you have to develop your own methods of defending yourself, defending your country, defending the sovereignty of your country. So this is a rational and logical development of events in the region. If you have any other country in the world just remaining them, putting them with their back to the wall, receiving attacks all the time by an aggressive force, it is natural and more than natural to just retaliate in order to stop the aggression against you.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mohsen, what about that? Do you think that the narrative has basically changed and we've gone from a time where Israel would basically deal with hit and run, but now we're more likely to see a tit for tat, and Tel Aviv realizes and understands that the transition has taken place?
Absolutely, it does, and their military generals have acknowledged this. I think in practical terms, you can see from their tactics, every time that there is a head-on collision with any of the resistance, and I'm including the Palestinian resistance most recently, if we include the Lebanese resistance, or even if we talk about the Syrian resistance, the fact of the matter is that Israel no longer rattles its saber in the way that it used to. What it does now, it does this kind of lower form of, if you like, tit for tat, as you put it, quite succinctly. That's just designed to really make everybody think that they've still got, the nerve to face up to the resistance axis. But increasingly, what we're seeing is that they are not even able to outright launch land invasions, for instance. They didn't do it again with Gaza, that open-air prison camp which they maintained. They couldn't really do exactly what they wanted after so many Palestinian resistance missiles violated their so-called Iron Dome. So again, the Iron Dome has been shattered as an impregnable defense mechanism, and that's been done by the resistance axis's own tactics, which penetrated the Israeli defense. We know that in Lebanon, the much-wanted Israeli military with its state-of-the-art tanks, etc., was taken out by very simple Lebanese Hezbollah forces tactics, using particular anti-tank missiles in a certain way where they could hit these tanks from both angles, shocking the Israeli forces and actually forcing their retreat inflicting a major damage to the morale of the army, which I don't think they've recovered. It's admitted even by the Israeli generals themselves that they don't have that scale of morale. What's happening now is really a fundamental sea change. You have an Israeli defense force of basically young people that they conscript, they're forced to serve in the army, essentially. They've got, the resistance axis, which because of the Israeli and the Zio-American shenanigans in the Middle East, have been now trained with wars in Syria, with wars in Iraq, with wars across that region, which have been instigated by these Zio-imperialists. Trained up. They basically made those forces battle-hardened. And what the Israeli Defense Force is scared of is that their own individual conscripts, who never faced a real war, haven't fought real soldiers or a real army, for that matter, are not really up to the job. They're therefore relying on aircraft attacks or internet warfare or these little tactical hijacking attacks of ships around the world. That's what they're reduced to.
Well, Mohammed, now Iran has said that it holds Israel responsible for terrorist attacks against it, and that Tehran will protect this region against aggression. I mean, what exactly does that mean? Do you think that it means that anywhere in the region where Tel Aviv crosses Tehran's red lines could mean trouble for the Zionist regime?
Yes, absolutely. But if you follow up the Israeli media today, you'd just be astonished at how much they have been confused, how much they have been contradicting each other. You have reports that are blaming Israel for itself, itself for playing with fire in the first place. You have some politicians, Israeli politicians, claiming that they will need to retaliate for that attack. And then you have others just quoting officials that they will report the case to the UN and they will have their case there. So a sort of confusion. As I said in the first section of my what I said, the Israelis are not used to this. They have been used to be the thug of the area and then launch aggressions against all the peoples of the region and then returning home safely with their warplanes and so, and then receiving a pat on the shoulder by the Americans and the other Western forces, and this country or that European country is offering them official and, financial and economic aid this way or another. You have, for example, you see fruits and the produce of the settlements, the occupied settlements that the whole world believes are occupied and UN believes are occupied Palestinian territories. You have them offered the special and favorite way of treatment by the European countries. So you see, the whole thing is a new phase for the Israelis, always been used to just launch aggressions and go unpunished.
What about that transition, said Mohsen? I mean, overall, what does this attack say about the strength of the resistance and the change, as Mohammed was just talking about, that the regime in Tel Aviv is not used to this type of response?
Well, you can clearly see the progression from very confident Israeli war stances during the Yom Kippur War and, you know, even in the time of the conquest of the Golan Heights. And you can see the difference in the postures of the Israelis. And that's primarily one of a much more cautious, much more defensive, much more nervous nature on the Israelis' part. That's purely and simply because they recognize and they understand, their intelligence services, their military intelligence understands the military capabilities which the resistance axis now has. Of course, the raids in Syria are primarily a sort of a knee-jerk, nervous reaction to the fact that the Islamic Republic of Iran has free brotherly access to Syrian territory in order to defend Syria's sovereignty, which has been violated again by ISIS and the sort of forces that the Western imperialists have been imposing on Syria. But that nervousness obviously manifests with these kind of constant aerial raids. That's the only area in which the Israelis now feel that they have a clear superiority. Of course, the other area that we need to consider is the ballistic missile capability. And Israel will argue that, well, we're going in to destroy the capability of Iran, particularly in Syria, or the Syrians themselves, of being able to launch ballistic missile attacks from those territories. This is, quite frankly, nonsense. What they're really doing is they're just trying to keep up appearances for their own citizens. Look, when the Israelis bomb or try to attack Syrian sites, there's no confirmation of the actual locations that they're hitting actually being of any real significance. You know, casualties are reported, all too often civilian casualties. Israel itself doesn't provide any evidence that they've been able to take out so-called military or Iranian military bases, or Syrian ones for that matter. What's really going on is quite often they're just going through an exercise of trying to look like they're still in the game. The Russians have an interesting role to play in this. they could give S-400s to the Syrian air defense or the resistance. They certainly say they've given S-300s, and we know that Israeli missiles have been intercepted. So clearly there is a deterrence power that the resistance has. Iran itself has highly sophisticated ballistic missiles, which they demonstrated with their destruction of Ain al-Assad base in Iraq when the Americans went for their own mad scheme of killing and martyring Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. So what we've got is a situation now where the old Israeli-American imperialism is desperately trying to keep its own citizens, its own people on board to say, look, we still have the capability to defend you. They're losing that battle, because and what we've got is a resistance axis proving day on day that they are getting ever closer to really shutting down the illegitimate Israel occupation.
Okay, stay with me, Most. What about that, Mohammed? Do you think that Tel Aviv is more vulnerable today than it ever has been in its existence?
Yes, of course. But the more important is the impact of this whole thing. I mean, strategically speaking, that the role of Israel, and this, by the way, a statement was made by current President Joe Biden, explaining why he supports Israel. He says that Israel is cheaper than any warplane carrier or whatever that we would put here in order to put our troops. So this tells you about the function that the West sees in Israel. Israel that used to launch aggressions, as we've been saying since the beginning of the show, throughout its history, 70 years ago, is now unable to launch an aggression on Gaza without expecting a retaliation. So this is means a major change and a shift in the function of Israel. Israel is no longer the barricade or the barracks of the West.
Okay.
They are not order to take a certain product from that entity.
I'm so sorry to interrupt you. I'd love to continue talking about this, but we're out of time. I appreciate both of you being with us. Political commentator Mohammed Obaid out of Beirut, journalist and political commentator Syed Mohsen Abbas out of London. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Suratul Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَلَا نُكَلِّفُ نَفْسًا إِلَّا وُسْعَهَا وَلَدَيْنَا كِتَابٌ يَنطِقُ بِالْحَقِّ وَهُمْ لَا يُظْلَمُونَ
And we charge no soul except with that within its capacity. And with us is a record which speaks with truth, and they will not be wronged.
The 62nd verse of the chapter says, وَلَا نُكَلِّفُ نَفْسًا إِلَّا وُسْعَهَا وَلَدَيْنَا كِتَابٌ يَنْطِقُ بِالْحَقِّ وَهُمْ لَا يُظْلَمُونَ And we do not task a soul but to the extent of its ability, and with us is record which clearly speaks the truth. And they will not be dealt with unjustly. You may remember, dear listeners, the special attributes of the believers mentioned in the previous programs about the different previous verses. They were the sources of all their good deeds, and they were the reason they were speeding and hastening onto doing good deeds. But this brings the question forth, that not anyone can acquire such attributes, nor all individuals have the ability of doing them. Then what should those people do? This verse implies that Allah never obliges a person to do more than his power and strength, but He expects everyone to do as much as his intelligence and capability can accomplish. In Islamic jurisprudence, there is a rule based on this verse called the negation of distress and constriction. This rule governs all Islamic rulings and holds a priority over them all. It means that when an obligation causes intolerance or hardship, that obligation becomes nullified. It is somehow invalidated. Even if you try to do your best as a servant, and for example, while you're sick, you try to fast, that fasting is invalidated. It is not accepted because it was more than your capability. It was more than what you could do. So the duties are not the same for all individuals. Everyone's obligations are related to his or her physical, intellectual, and resource capabilities. And some of the jurisprudents say that Allah will not accept if you try to somehow exceed your capabilities in doing your servanthood tasks.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
أَنْتُمُ
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
So, Allah does not expect the obligations of the poor to be the same as that of the rich. The verse says, وَلَا نُكَلِّفُ نَفْسًا إِلَّا وُسْعَهَا. We do not task a soul, but to the extent of its ability. So Allah never obliges a person to do more than his power and strength. And everyone is expected to do as much as their capabilities are. Divine duties and prescripts are in accordance with human strength and capability, and whenever a duty exceeds one's power, one becomes exempt from that duty, and as the scholars of methodology say, this method governs all Islamic ordinances and is prior to them. It might be asked, how will the deeds, big or small, of all human beings be reckoned? The verse says, وَلَدَيْنَا كِتَابٌ يَنْطِقُ بِالْحَقِّ. And with us is a record which clearly speaks the truth. وَهُمْ لَا يُظْلَمُونَ. And they will not be dealt with unjustly. This refers to the record in which all of man's deeds are recorded and stands before Allah. It seems that this record can speak and tell the truth in such a way that it is not possible to deny. So, anyway, regarding what was said in the previous verse, the fact that those believers try to do their best and exceed the others, and they hasten on to doing good things, this verse says that you have some capabilities over which excess and extravagance is prohibited. And this verse is somehow acting as a limit, not just to the previous verse, but also to all rules of jurisprudence in Islam. And this causes an interesting effect in the society and community of the believers. With having this kind of divine ideology, no one will feel inferior, and no one will feel that humility and lowliness before the others, because he or she knows that he has done his or her best based upon his and her capabilities. This is all the Almighty Allah has wanted from him or her, and whatever the Almighty Allah has wanted is accomplished. So there is no reason not to be calm. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care. Goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Around the world with reporters.
There There is no evidence of institutional racism in the UK, says a report commissioned by the British government, but a landmark art exhibition on the doorsteps of Queen Elizabeth II paints a very different picture.
War in the Babylon is the title of this exhibition about black communities and their long struggle against systemic racism here in the UK. It comes 10 years after the police killing of unarmed black man Mark Duggan on the streets of London, with the aim of shining a light on his family's struggle for justice, as well as many more families who have lost a loved one at the hands of the British state.
Since 1990, there have been 1,433 people who have died in police custody. While the majority of deaths are white British, there is a disproportionate overrepresentation of black people who die as a result of use of force or restraint by the police.
10 years since the killing of Mark Duggan, but in 2015, in Haringey, the same borough, they killed Jermaine Baker. Last week, we had a notice put out that another person of colour, black person, has been killed in Haringey by the same police.
Stafford Scott, the curator of the exhibition, and who supported many of these families in their fight for justice, designed the showcase to illustrate how systemic racism is not just present in the police force, but something that permeates through different institutions in British society.
The War in the Babylon is an exhibition that we hope encapsulates the entirety of the black experience in the UK. You'd have recently heard this foolishness from some report by some geezer called Tony Sewell that said that there's no such thing as institutional racism in this country. War in the Babylon says that that's an absolute lie and provides the absolute evidence that that is a lie.
The pictures, videos and texts present an account for those whose voices are often not heard, or worse still, willfully ignored by the mainstream.
We're at the Mall. That's the same address as the Queen of England, the Queen of England resides. We've moved the front line in the fight against racism and the fight for truth and rights from off of the estates, from out of the hood, and we've taken it right to the heart of the establishment.
The need for exhibitions like this is as pertinent now as it's ever been, especially as the British government expands policies like racially disproportionate blanket stop and search, while simultaneously denying the existence of institutional racism, signalling to black communities in the UK that their historic fight for equality is far from over. Ahmed Cabello, London.
Palestinians accused Israel of using unjustified deadly force against Palestinian children in the occupied West Bank. In its latest report, Defense for Children International Palestine stated that the Israeli soldiers continue to kill Palestinian children with no recourse or accountability. In its report, DCI Palestine revealed that evidence it has obtained shows children killed didn't pose any threat to the Israeli soldiers at the time of their killing. The group says that Israeli forces used lethal force against Palestinian children in circumstances that may amount to extrajudicial or willful killing.
Killing unarmed minors amounts to war crime and even crime against humanity. Israeli soldiers act in line with shoot-to-kill policy, opening fire to kill Palestinian children. The troopers know their military establishment will hold any of them accountable for killing innocent Palestinians.
On Friday, a 17-year-old Palestinian boy, Mohammed Tamimi, was fatally shot by live ammunition in his back during a peaceful anti-settlement protest that was held in Nabi Saleh town, West Ramallah. Meanwhile, on Monday, a 17-year-old Yusuf Nawaf Mhareb, a resident of the Ramallah area village of Abwin, succumbed to wounds he had sustained a prayer when he was shot in the neck by Israeli forces during a protest against Israel's aggression on the Gaza Strip. Experts say that under international law, the use of lethal force during a protest is allowed only when a direct and lethal threat to life or of serious injury exists. And as usual, Israel continues violating international law, including rules which limit the intentional lethal use of firearms, in particular against children.
Israeli forces have a twofold purpose by targeting Palestinian children. First, they want to intimidate Palestinian children to prevent them from taking part in anti-Israeli activity, and second, to oppress the Palestinians in general, to impose and strengthen the Israeli military control.
Since the beginning of the year, 10 Palestinian miners were killed in the occupied West Bank by Israeli forces using live ammunition. Palestinians accuse Israel of using unjustified force against their children. They even warn that Israeli soldiers will continue killing children in cold blood as long as they won't face inquiry. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Speaker of Iran's parliament, Mohammad Baqir Qalibov, has met Syria's President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. Assad said that Iran is a main partner for Syria, which offered its support in all sectors. He asserted that ongoing coordination for fighting terror had a positive impact on the ground and will continue until the liberation of all Syrian territories. Qalibov said the Syrian and Iranian people's determination to participate in the recent presidential elections in the two countries proves the failure of policies of pressure adopted by their enemies. Qalibov held a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart, Hamoudeh Sabbagh. He said military and political relations with Syria are currently in their strongest and best form, expressing willingness to enhance economic cooperation with Syria.
After their failure in military war against Iran, the Zionist and U.S. regimes have waged an economic war against us. Our joint priority now is to achieve development in our countries, improve our economy, restore the infrastructure, and increase the bulk of mutual trade exchange.
Sabbagh referred to the high level of coordination between parliaments of Iran and Syria, affirming that the two countries stand together in the resistance alliance, working to eliminate hegemony and colonialism, which their enemies are imposing on the region.
We held a very special and important meeting for further coordination between both parliaments through consultations and the exchange of expertise. We also agreed on activating the work of our friendship committees in the two parliaments for the benefit of the two peoples.
Speaker Qalibov also held talks with Syria's Prime Minister Hussein Arnous. They underlined the importance of expansion of economic cooperation in both public and private sectors for facing economic sanctions, as well as the siege imposed on the Iranian and Syrian people. The exchange of visits between Iranian and Syrian officials reflects the strong historic ties between the two countries. There has been a noticeable development in economic, political, military, and parliamentary cooperation since the start of the war on Syria, which represents an alliance both states are strengthening to counter U.S. and Western pressure against them. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki and his wife.
Addressing the press, a member of Zazaki's defense team said the Kaduna State High Court discharged and acquitted Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat of all 8 charges in a ruling that lasted for several hours. The judge ruled that the prosecution has failed to establish any case against the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria and his wife.
The court ruled that the charge ought not to be in the first place. You cannot arraign a man for an offense that was allegedly committed, as at the time the said crime was not an offense. And the court was very emphatic in that. That yes, the Kaduna State government has powers to enact laws, but they cannot enact laws to prosecute an offense retrospectively.
Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat were arrested in December 2015 following an attack on his home and worship center by soldiers of the Nigerian army, which resulted in the killing of hundreds of Zazaki's supporters. In a statement, the Islamic movement said the judgment is a vindication of Sheikh Zazaki and a victory for truth and justice against tyranny and oppression.
The events of December 12th and 15th of 2015 were orchestrated by state machineries who are using the instrumentalities of state apparatus to fight a religious fight. It is strictly, the event of December 12, 2015 is strictly a fight between Shiites and Sunnis, fights that was imported from Saudi Arabia for whatever purpose.
The Kaduna State High Court has set Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat free. The Islamic movement, and indeed many of Zazaki's supporters, have expressed happiness with the outcome of this judgment. Benjamin Abdullahi, Kaduna.
Okay.
3,000 of Ethiopian refugees crossed the Sudanese borders on Monday, arriving at Taya village at Basunda locality in Gadarif state. Reports say the refugees is considered the biggest number of refugees to cross into the country in only one day since the outbreak of war last November in Tigray region. Many believe that the wave may worsen security and humanitarian situation in the region due to armed conflicts erupting at western area of Ethiopia.
Sudan has adopted an open-door policy in receiving Ethiopian refugees since the beginning of the conflict. So far, Sudan has welcomed about 75,000 to 80,000 refugees. We call on the international community to help us meet the needs of the increasing refugees fleeing from the fight in the Tigray region.
Since the beginning of fighting, tens of thousands of Ethiopians have sought safety in Sudan, but conditions in Sudan refugee camps are presenting a new challenges, as Sudanese NGOs early responded to humanitarian situation in states affected of refugees influx.
Actually, since the crisis of the refugees started, the Tigray crisis started, Sudanese Red Crescent has been present from day one. And that is basically because we do have our ongoing activities in the region through our branches in Kassala and Gadarif. So we do have ongoing programs for the already existed old refugees in the area. So with the beginning of the crisis, we were already on the ground.
In the light of the latest development in the Tigray region, UN agencies strive to maintain a strong staff presence, provided there is access in Hamadayet in case there is an increased influx. Several partners continue to remain on the ground in anticipation of this possibility.
Security and health challenges face Sudanese and Ethiopian governments to cope with increasing number of refugees. Khartoum says it is still waiting for international support to tackle the crisis. Muhammad Ali Fazari, Khartoum.
An Algerian judoka athlete who made headlines last week for shunning an Israeli opponent at the Tokyo Olympics has now been temporarily suspended along with his coach from the International Judo Federation, meaning that Fethi Nurin will not be able to compete after making his bold statement in support of Palestine. After returning to Algeria, V secured an exclusive interview with Nurin to ask why he felt he had to walk.
I was pitted to play against an athlete from the usurper entity occupying Palestinian land, a regime which kills innocent people and drives them out of their homes, day and night. Because of this, I don't accept that my hand is smeared with someone who represents an entity like this, and for his flag to be associated with the Algerian flag, which is in support of the Palestinians' cause.
His actions meant he would miss out on a chance to win a medal, but Nurin admitted he had no regrets.
If the same situation arises, I would not hesitate to take the same decision. The world needs to know that Israel is an occupier and they practice all kinds of laws that deviate from the international laws and human rights. We need to send a message to the world that we deal with all religions with dignity, just as the Islamic religion recommended us to do. Except for the ones who fight against the religion and the Muslims. We are against them and it's our rights to respond to them. We have the right to defend our religion and all oppressed Muslims.
The Olympic Charter takes a strong stance against any political acts, stating that no kind of demonstration or political, religious or racial propaganda is permitted.
However, this isn't the first time that a Muslim athlete has protested against this controversial lineup. Many are now starting to ask questions about the Olympics and their lack of sensitivity on the subject. Also, are the games being used to whitewash Israel at a time when Palestinians remain deeply oppressed? Robert Carter, London.
More and more people in the EU are congregating indoors. The highly contagious Delta variant of COVID-19 is spreading like wildfire in countries like France and Spain. More people are also travelling within the EU. Citizens in Brussels have been sharing their thoughts on the Delta variant.
I don't know where the cases come from, if it's a coffee restaurant or just meeting in our house.
when I see how people are behaving sometimes, I'm not surprised.
The European Central Bank, which manages the euro, says economic confidence is being undermined.
The pandemic continues to cast a shadow, especially as the Delta variant constitutes a growing source of uncertainty.
On Monday, EU finance ministers rubber-stamped COVID-19 recovery funding for four additional nations in the 27-country bloc.
Croatia, Cyprus, Lithuania and Slovenia. Now more than a half of national plans is adopted.
However, critics say the billions of euro being administered to national governments will result in citizens being saddled with decades more austerity because there is too much emphasis on loans rather than grants. According to analysts, EU leaders are harming the bloc's economy through their foreign policy. Sanctions are inhibiting trade. Economists say the Iranian market represents a big opportunity. It can be availed of if current efforts to save the JCPOA Iran nuclear deal succeed. We have been speaking to the head of the European Parliament's Iran delegation about the subject via Skype. She believes the agreement will be reinstated soon.
Many people in Iran say, again and again and again, we have not a good partner on this side. This is one of the impacts of this horrible, stupid policy of Trump.
The International Labour Organization, ILO, warns an additional 25 million jobs could be lost globally before the end of this year due to the coronavirus. However, the ILO says if we see an internationally coordinated policy response, the number of people losing their jobs could be much lower. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Lebanese Prime Minister-designate Najib Mikati said he hoped he can regain the trust of the people and the role of the state. He also vowed to meet with President Michel Aoun regularly in order to speed up the formation of the new government.
There is full unanimity on demand and swiftness in the formation of the new government. And after today's session, I brief President Aoun on the outcome, and I always visit the presidential palace in order to achieve the government's formation as soon as possible.
Mikati spoke after a day of non-binding meetings with Lebanese lawmakers who stated their views after separate consultations. Free Patriotic Movement declared it will not be taking part in the next government, but will offer all the necessary facilitations and support for a quick formation.
We're starting from scratch. We're starting something new, no baggage. No one is carrying any historical disagreements between the parties. That's what we heard from the designated prime minister, and we hope that that will be reflected in the coming future, within hours or days at least, that this will make a difference.
Prime Minister designate stressed that he has the foreign support necessary to begin economic reforms. One member of parliament told Press TV that when they asked about this support, Mikati stressed that France has given him assurances that after the formation of the cabinet, they will give all assistance to resolve the financial and economic crisis. However, this assistance will not be without interest.
No foreign country would give assistance for free. It has its own interest in mind as well. It's only natural when France gives aid to Lebanon, it has ambitions. If France assists in rebuilding the port, it could be the main future authority in the port of Beirut and could be managing the trade and commerce from Europe to the entire Arab world. If it rebuilds the electricity sector, it will also be a good investment for French companies. And at the same time, Lebanon is in drastic need of that assistance.
The main concern for all sides is salvaging the country's economy, which has been described by the World Bank as one of the world's worst since the 1850s. After initial meetings with lawmakers, the real political bargaining begins for the formation of the government. This in itself could prove to be controversial, with Mikati stressing the need for keeping to the French initiative, opponents stressing the need for adhering to the National Charter of Confessional Representation. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
The British government has decided to expand blanket stop and search powers under a new plan to beat crime. Measures unveiled on Tuesday include changes to police powers to allow searching people without suspicion in areas where they believe violence could break out under the Section 60 Criminal Justice and Public Order Act.
Across all stop and searches powers, black people are 9 times more likely to be stopped than white people. But under the Section 60 Act, that rate is even higher at a whopping 18 times. Moreover, the research data shows that in 99% of Section 60 searches, no weapon is found.
Press TV got a reaction to this story from Charles Critchlow, former president of the National Black Police Association. He said,
"This government has abandoned any pretense of a desire for a fair and just society, particularly insofar as black people are concerned. First of all, the efficacy of such an approach is not proven. Moreover, it's counterproductive in that it alienates the community when the support of the community is critical."
His thoughts were echoed by Suleiman Lee, a community activist from Black Child Promotions, who himself has been harassed by the police.
There's always going to be conflict at street level. There's disorganized crime, then there's organized crime. And as I said before, black youth cannot facilitate any criminal underworld. They can only participate. A lot of black youth, they're serving time. Even though we're 3% of the population, according to the 2011 census, we're disproportionately represented in the prisons at Her Majesty's pleasure.
The government announcement came 2 months after the Criminal Justice Alliance, a network of 160 organisations, called for the power to be repealed, arguing that Section 60 had led to thousands of innocent people being unnecessarily stopped and searched every year, with the number of searches rising from 622 in 2016 to 2017 to more than 18,000 in 2019 to 2020. It seems unlikely that Priti Patel will bow to pressure from campaigners after already dismissing the criticisms levied against the plans, much like she dismissed the sentiments behind the Black Lives Matter protest that swept throughout the UK. Ahmed Cabello, London.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan? La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadiri, coming to you from your program, Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting to you, as usual, from IRIB English Radio. Joining us in the studio is our dear friend and esteemed guest, Sheikh Murtada Karimi from the Islamic Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sheikh. Sheikh, our topic question today is maybe a controversial one for somebody who is not familiar with the Islamic laws and principles mm-hmm. and the beliefs that we have as Muslims. The question is as follows. Why, when bearing witness, giving witness, in, for example, in court, the testimonial of a woman is only worth half of a man's testimonial? Like, at first glance, it seems that this is discriminatory and this is not fair. So why do we have this concept in Islam, dear Sheikh, for somebody who's looking from outside wanting to understand this?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The scholars of jurisprudence, they have discussed the issue of bearing witness in a court, and many people might think that in all the cases, the testimonial of man is, or women is half in value regarding compared to that of the men. But this is not the case. In some cases, only the testimonial of women is accepted when it comes to issues related to women. And in those cases, that of the men is not accepted at all. In some cases, it is vice versa. It is only accepted from men and not from women. And in some cases, the testimonial